Well, we have a new roller coming out. And the dice are coming out this point.
In our imagination, this is the sound of Las Vegas. Blackjack, craps, slots, roulette. But in reality, that dinging, dice-throwing, card-playing, spinning side of Las Vegas, well, it's dying.
Vegas is moving farther and farther away from gaming, and it's almost like an afterthought at this point. The money generated in casinos is a pinprick compared to what casinos are getting from the shows and the restaurants and the shopping. It forced the city to change its philosophy and to change its strategy.
Last week, we delved into the booming food and drink scene on the Strip with What Happens in Vegas, an hour-long look inside those very restaurants and bars that are now the bread and butter of Las Vegas tourism. Today, we look at what you might call the real Las Vegas, the unions, the water system, the immigrants, and restaurants off the Strip. People live there, remember, and they aren't eating at Joël Robuchon every night. From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleinman, and this is part two of Good Food's Las Vegas special. We're calling it Stays in Vegas. If all the news lately has you feeling kind of cynical about the notion of the American dream, then maybe you should take a closer look at Las Vegas. The city has one of the largest unionized workforces in the country. It's perhaps one of the last places in America where a line cook can actually raise a family on just his kitchen salary. To find out more about the city's unions, we reached out to Ed Comenda. In his role as gaming reporter for the Las Vegas Sun, he covers a lot of union news. Hi, Ed.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm great. So how prevalent are the unions in Las Vegas, and who do they cover mostly?
Oh, my goodness. Well, they're very prevalent. I mean, there's about 55,000 union workers in Vegas right now, and they work at about 33 of the 40 properties along the Strip. I mean, for Caesars Entertainment, for instance, the biggest gaming company in the world, 13,000 of their employees are union members. If you look at somebody like MGM, you know, they have 20,000 union members on their payroll. So they're pretty prevalent.
So does that mean that a cook, just a regular cook, not a fancy chef, but a regular cook can actually have a decent living in Las Vegas?
A very decent living, I'd say. I mean, if you look at the numbers and what cooks, actually any sort of union member in Vegas with the culinary chapter, cooks make about $16 an hour, which is about twice as much as what a cook would make in Illinois.
Or so, Los Angeles.
The American dream is still alive in Vegas for that reason, and it's sort of, it's a destination for people in these hospitality positions. You come to Vegas because you want to be able to make a living, you want to have a family, and Vegas still has a place for that.
And so along with the decent pay, are there decent working hours, and if people work overtime, do they get paid for overtime?
For the most part, most workers have full-time work weeks. They have 40 hours. Granted, when the recession hit, there were a lot of cuts at casinos, but the workers who remained on duty sustained these 40-hour work weeks. They have health insurance, and they have a guaranteed paycheck.
So I would imagine that workers, the unionized workers, have a great deal of power given that there are so many of them.
Yeah, their strength is in their numbers, and you see that at places like the Cosmopolitan, where the workers aren't unionized, but on any given weekend you'll find 3,000-4,000 workers outside picketing, you know, screaming into microphones because there are workers there that want contracts, but aren't able to organize there. So there's strength in numbers, and there's this great solidarity that's happening. And the thing is, casino companies have been struggling for the last several years, and one of the things they've been struggling with is guaranteeing these union contracts. But it's not like they could just divorce the union because, I mean, it's not easy to sever ties with 55,000 employees.
Now, are the people who work the casino floors themselves dealers? Are they unionized as well as other hospitality workers?
Yeah, there's a dealer's union, there's a culinary union, there's a bartender's union. The bartenders and the culinary sort of fall under the same umbrella, and then the dealer's union is separate. But yes, the dealers are also involved in a union as well.
You know, when we were there and we were getting into conversations with all kinds of folks about just the whole essence of Las Vegas, a lot of people would just sort of casually mention sort of the decline of the casino income and the rise of income in other aspects of Vegas entertainment. Has that also affected sort of the union paradigm there?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we just got through with the bulk of contract negotiations with all of the casino companies on the Strip. There's still a few that have yet to sign new contracts with the union. But the reality is the union as well as the casinos, there was a point where they believed that things would just keep getting better and better. More money would keep coming to Las Vegas. And what happened was... You know, the recession, the bottom fell out, and casinos found themselves harboring this massive debt. Caesars Entertainment has twice as much debt as the city of Detroit. I mean, they have something like $23 billion in debt. MGM has something like $13 billion in debt. So the union is still a constant in Las Vegas, but what's not a constant is this financial stability. And the casinos are continually fighting for that while fighting the unions because the unions want their health insurance. They want their 40-hour work weeks. They want their stellar pay. And like I said earlier, their healths are inextricably linked. I mean, you can't just cut 55,000 workers out of the workforce and expect things to go on without a hitch. So the casinos are very wary of that fight. And it's not a fight that they could win very easily.
Ed Comenda is a reporter for the Las Vegas Sun, where he covers the gaming beat and a lot of other interesting things, one of which is the Downtown Project, a revitalization project in downtown Las Vegas, courtesy of Zappos founder Tony Hsieh. Here's Ed again with an explanation.
Tony Hsieh, he moved his Zappos empire to downtown Las Vegas from Henderson about 3 years ago. And with that, he brought with him this plan to revitalize downtown. And his efforts turned into this thing called the Downtown Project. There was a point downtown where things were sort of stagnant and nobody really knew what was happening there. And Tony sort of came and provided the vision. So yeah, it's interesting to see that happening now.
How would you characterize it? Is it sort of like the hipster Las Vegas?
It's very much hipster. I mean, it's the tech crowd taking over a community downtown, trying to create one. And so yeah, it's younger, you know, fresh out of college kids trying to make some good. I mean, that's what they say. Depending on who you talk to, you might get completely different answers on that.
No matter what the locals feel about the Downtown Project, it's really hard to argue with the success of EAT, a breakfast and lunch cafe run by Chef Natalie Young. EAT's the kind of place where locals can eat a couple of times a week, and it's the most touted success story to come from Mr. Hsieh's Downtown Project thus far. I caught up with Chef Natalie outside the cafe. We're sitting out here on a bench, Chef Natalie and I, looking out at Container Park in downtown Las Vegas. There's a tattoo parlor on one corner, police car parked across the street, and there's a bit of activity in the sky. Kind of a typical morning.
Typical.
Where are you from originally?
I grew up in Colorado.
And how did you find your way to Las Vegas?
Believe it or not, I was living in Telluride, Colorado, and I found that I needed a life change, and I came down here to get sober.
Oh, that's so interesting. Had you been chefing in Colorado?
Oh, absolutely. My whole life, that's all I've ever done.
What happens when you're sort of an itinerant chef coming into Vegas? Do you end up moving up a food chain of different hotel restaurants?
Basically what I did, because I came here under different circumstances, I came here to kind of start my life over and change. So I started at the bottom and worked my way up. I went to a beautiful restaurant called the Eiffel Tower in the Paris Hotel, a classic French restaurant. And I cooked for a year so I could focus on my sobriety.
So how long between that period of time and you opened EAT?
About 10 years.
So you paid your dues.
Oh, well, yeah, I've been cooking for 20 years, sure.
So, you know, when I think about Las Vegas, I think about a city that's filled with really skilled people.
Sure.
In the hospitality business, both in the kitchen and in the front of the house. What finally made you decide to step out from a larger property and go out on your own?
You know, I think it was just one day I was staying in a very large kitchen with a very large staff, and it just came across to me that, you know, there was no more love in the food, in my opinion. I just remembered and longed for the days where people, like, really thought about what they were preparing and what they were going to serve people, and that people ingest that product, that it's just not about the bottom line. And why can't we have an experience where people, like, sit down and have a conversation at eat? There's no gambling, no alcohol, no, what do you call it, internet, no smoking. So it's really an opportunity for people to sit down and just look each other in the eye and have a conversation and have a great meal, break bread. You know, I think we lost that somehow.
How important was it for you that the downtown area was being looked at in a different way after the financial crash?
So basically what happened is I'd made the decision to leave the property that I was at, and I didn't know anything about EAT, that EAT was going to happen. And I was going to move to New Mexico, and a company, Downtown Project, approached me and asked me if I would consider staying, and offered to fully finance the restaurant. So I'd been coming to downtown for probably a good 2 or 3 years. And I felt like I found my tribe. Like in Las Vegas, you know, there's a lot of different people, but downtown to me just feels really real with some really decent humans and a sense of community. I know my neighbors, you know, and prior to getting involved in downtown, that wasn't the case.
Are most of your customers locals?
So the strange thing about EAT is we have people from all over the world, all over the country. All demographics. It doesn't make any sense. You can see elderly people, young people, hipsters, gay people, straight people, black people, white people. You see all sorts of people here in EAT. Everybody is welcome. Everybody's welcome.
Was it a shock to become a chef owner operator after being an employee in those large properties?
You know, I was just sitting at the table with my friend, and I was telling her, I go, this is unbelievable to me. Still today, I sit back and I go, who would have thought? Like, you know, some people took a chance on me, gave me a little bit of money and said, do your thing. And it's like the whole community has just embraced EAT. And so basically what has happened is due to the large, wonderful outpour of the community, I've been able to pay off the loan in 1 year and 4 months. And I have 4 partners, and I've been able to write that last check on February 14th.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
That was your Valentine's Day present to yourself.
It was my Valentine's present to Tony Hsieh, who took a chance on me.
What a pleasure to meet you.
Nice to meet you as well.
Natalie Young is the chef owner behind EAT, the first fully funded business from Tony Hsieh's Downtown Project. I spoke with her outside of her cafe on the corner of 7th and Carson in downtown Las Vegas. Coming up, a 13-year-old boy launches a truffle importing business from his high school dorm room. 15 years later, he finds himself in Las Vegas selling lionfish. Find out how this wunderkind has grown his artisanal business into a platform for sustainability.
This is Jillian Ferguson, producer of Good Food. Keep up with us all week long on our blog. You'll find recipes, photos, cooking tips, and videos. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood.
Welcome back to Good Food. You're listening to Stays in Vegas, part 2 of our Las Vegas special. A curious boy has his first taste of truffle-scented pasta and becomes one of the largest suppliers of high-quality truffles to the home market in the U.S. at a very tender age, at the age of 13. Brett Ottolenghi is the owner of Artisanal Foods. Dana Goodyear, an incredible writer, profiled him in The New Yorker as the forager of the outrageous and obscure for high-end chefs here in Las Vegas. We're sitting in the storage room of Brett's retail store, Artisanal Foods, surrounded by cases of unbelievable olive oil, high-end vinegars, and just things that are catnip to the gourmet. There's one box up here that says pork clouds on it. Thank you so much for letting us in here, Brett.
Thank you for having me.
So when you tasted the truffles, what I'm curious about is the truffle connection you made was a quite specific truffle connection that brought a quality of truffle that hadn't been seen before to a gourmet home cook.
The products that were more accessible to home gourmets at the time were things like truffle oil. But if you lived in the middle of the country, away from a major city, and you wanted to have fresh truffles, there really was not a way to get them at that point. The internet, of course, in 1998 was just becoming popular. And so at the time, the only two places on the internet to buy a fresh truffle were either Dean & DeLuca or my website, which was called The Truffle Market.
And The Truffle Market kind of undercut Dean & DeLuca a little bit.
Yeah, that was our first big break. We got a wonderful piece of press in Newsweek where they just had a blurb saying, it pays to shop for your truffles. And I forget the price difference, but I think we were something like 35 or 40% cheaper than Dean & DeLuca at the time. And it really was an oversight on my part. I just didn't know what to charge for them. It wasn't so much that I was an especially acute business person.
You were a kid.
Right.
Is it true that you were fulfilling orders from the website from your dorm room at boarding school?
At boarding school, I would do the accounting and the bookkeeping. I would work on the website. The actual fulfillment was being done by some of my father's employees who I would pay on the side to pack a few orders for me.
I just think it's extraordinary, your level of entrepreneurship so young. So let's cut now to your business here in Las Vegas, which I think is just a perfect outgrowth of how you started. Now you spend your life at the beck and call of uber high-end chefs who are pressed for time and need something that only you can find. It must be such a rush for you.
Every day is interesting. We get a lot of unusual requests from the purchasing departments and the chefs. You never know what ingredient they're going to ask for. And we're fortunate in that we've developed this reputation for the more exotic and interesting ingredients. So they really think of us first when there's something they can't find. I'm working on one right now. I can't say there's a chef really in line that buy this, but it's something I'm just curious about. And I'm researching glow protein that's refined from jellyfish, and it could potentially be used in different foods to make them glow.
I read an article about that. Has it already come to the place where they will actually sell the protein, like in a powdered form?
That's what we're working on. So far, the powder is only being sold more for scientific purposes. And so we're working with a company who hopes to be able to produce it at a cost-effective rate where it could be used in foods.
What better place could it possibly find a home than in Las Vegas, where the idea of glitz and glow is everywhere? Of course, you should have it on your plate. Do you feel that you're driving the interest of certain ingredients, or are you driven by chefs?
We often are trying to introduce new ingredients that we think will really inspire chefs and give them a new tool.
What's the most recent of those that you're really excited about?
Well, we've been introducing lionfish over the last 6 months. Lionfish is native to the South Pacific, and over the last 30 years, they've become an invasive species on the east coast of the United States. They have no natural predators. They have venomous spines which protect them. They don't respond to a hook. You can't catch them in a net because they hide in the reefs all day. So the only way to catch them is to spear them individually. Otherwise, they'll consume up to 80% of the other species living on the reef. All of these little fish that they're consuming would normally be eating algae. Because they're not eating the algae grows and blocks the sun from the coral, and then the coral dies. The missing link for me has always been access to the fish. I needed a fisherman. And so finally, about 6 months ago, I was watching a show called Shark Tank on NBC, and the last person to present, the last entrepreneur, was this man who's become a good friend of mine. His name is David Johnson, and he's a contractor by day, but his real passion is hunting these lionfish. And I emailed him, and within 2 hours of seeing the show, we were already in communication. We now have three restaurants that have been very patient with us as we bring this new fish into the market. And we've been working with, well, I shouldn't take the credit, David has been working with governments in island nations in the Caribbean and Mexico to get permission to hunt for these lionfish in currently protected reefs, because that's really where they're breeding. They're breeding in protected reefs.
Talking about issues of sustainability, shark fin has come to the forefront of the conversation ever since the ban for fishing in California. There's such a huge audience that comes to Las Vegas from China to stay in the incredible properties and gamble and eat really well. What is the situation with selling shark fin here in Las Vegas?
So shark fin is a really difficult situation or issue facing our town. I've spoken to a number of the county commissioners about trying to impose some type of ban on it. But it's really unrealistic to have any type of legislation that might ban shark fin in Vegas, simply because our most important gamblers are often Asian, and they believe that it gives them good luck and virility. So they like to eat shark fin soup while they gamble. I've heard of some guests eating as many as 15 bowls while playing blackjack for a couple of hours, and at a cost of $300 a bowl. And when I first became aware of the issue with shark fin, I said, well, okay, I need to find a great faux shark fin, and I got to talk to all the chefs and get them on board to use it. I thought that because the fake shark fin tasted and looked and felt and basically was identical to shark fin in every way, that it would work. It was also about one-fifth the price of real shark fin. It was actually made from tilapia tails that have been rolled and cut into strips. But at the end of the day, even though it tasted the same, looked the same, and was pretty much the same in every way, the chefs didn't want it because it wasn't shark. And the people who are eating shark fin, it's not about flavor. It's not really about nutritional value. It's about this mythological belief that by eating the predator of the sea, they'll become the predator on land. And so after, when that fell through, I decided to change my thought process a little bit. And I said, all right, well, if we can't replace shark fin, how can we get people to possibly choose something else on the menu? Could we put options on the menu that are so desirable, but perhaps more sustainable? And so rather than ordering the shark fin soup, they order something else. And so that's sort of the path that I'm on right now. And I'm trying to find very high-end, rarefied Chinese ingredients that could be so compelling to the guests that they choose that because they've seen shark fin before and they haven't seen this new thing.
I wish you a lot of luck in being able to do that. Thank you so much, Brett.
Thank you.
Brett Ottolenghi is the owner of Artisanal Foods. You can visit his retail store in Las Vegas, or you can find a lot of his products online at artisanalfoods.com. If we're talking about sourcing ingredients and sustainability, it's hard to ignore that most primal ingredient when you're in the desert, water. We've been talking a lot about California's water problems of late, so as we found ourselves wandering through those acres of air-conditioned interior space in Las Vegas, we grew really curious about their water situation. Doug Bennett is the conservation manager for the Southern Nevada Water Authority. Hi, Doug.
Hi, how are you, Evan?
I'm great, and I am very curious. So let's start with some basics. Where does Las Vegas get its water?
Well, we have two sources of water here, but about 90% of our water comes from the Colorado River via Lake Mead.
And yet, don't we also get some water from Lake Mead, Southern California?
Yeah, you do, as a matter of fact. In fact, the river itself is shared among seven U.S. states and the country of Mexico. And what a lot of people don't understand is even though we're literally right next door to that huge lake, only 2% of the water that's been allocated on that river was allocated to Nevada.
Wow, being a neighbor doesn't really help you much.
Well, you got to remember that the river was divided up in the 1920s. And in the 20s, the West was primarily about agriculture. California was becoming an agricultural stronghold. It had the ability to grow crops that were out of season in other parts of the nation. And so you had fresh produce that could go into the Midwest and back to the East that definitely couldn't be grown in those regions over the winter months. But you took it there via rail car. And of course, in those days, rail cars didn't have refrigeration. They had to be iced, and ice takes water. And by the time you hauled that produce across the desert from Southern California, you were out of ice and you needed some more. So one of the first critical assets in the Las Vegas region in the early 1900s was the water to supply the ice plant to ice the rail cars so that they could make it further inland to the population centers. And so there's a direct link to food.
Wow, what a fantastic piece of information. I had no idea. Thank you for that.
Oh, you're welcome.
So today, all of this water that you have coming from Lake Mead, I understand that it's now starting to look a little bit like there's a bathtub ring around the reservoir, that the water has been receding. Is that right?
That is right. And I think a lot of people in California can also relate to that phenomena. So you have that high water line that was there for so long. And as it withdrew, the minerals in the water that were deposited on the rock have left behind kind of a white, chalky bathtub ring around the lake. But, bathtub ring is kind of a scaled-down description because that ring is about 120 feet tall.
Wow. So how is the Las Vegas area coping? Do you have any other water sources at your disposal?
We do have another water source. So I said 90% comes from the Colorado River. The remaining 10% or so comes from groundwater supplies. And that's kind of an interesting story because it's that groundwater that literally bubbled out of a spring right here in the Las Vegas Valley that led to the founding of the town site. As far as those two water supplies, right now they make up the sum total of our fresh water supplies. We're looking at the ability to diversify our supplies by bringing in groundwater from other parts of Nevada. We also recycle all of our wastewater in the valley, so that also bolsters our supply. For every gallon of water we can take from the Colorado River, we actually get 1.7 gallons of use out of that water by recycling.
Now, when you say recycling, is this what some people call toilet to tap?
Well, we would never use that term, and it certainly is not indicative of the way that we recycle our water. So there are two ways to reuse your water. One is what's called direct reuse. And direct reuse means that you took a wastewater product, you treated it to a high grade, and then you put it straight into a pipe and delivered it to another use. And that's commonly used in our valley for golf course irrigation, parks, power plant cooling. And so that would be called direct reuse. And that certainly is, via a plant, almost a treatment and then connection of those pipes. But that water is going on landscape. So what we do with the rest of our wastewater is what we call indirect reuse. So that water is treated to a high standard and it's returned to the Colorado River right back into Lake Mead. And there's several miles of lake and an enormous volume of dilution between those two sources, the returned wastewater and the incoming water for our treatment plant. So it gets treated again.
So do you return any water to the aquifer?
We actually have been recharging the aquifer, and that's kind of one of the spinoffs from our conservation efforts. When our water use declined through conservation, we found that despite our very small allocation of Colorado River water, we had more Colorado River water than we were using. And so the key then becomes to see, where can I bank it? Where can I store it? Where can I put it for future use? And we were treating that water to drinking water standards and then using existing wells to pump the water back into the ground under our feet. Right now, that groundwater basin is so full that we don't really have the ability to put more water into it. And so we also bank water by trading it with the state of California. All our excess water can be banked with California, and California will pay back that debt at some time in the future.
Wow. Now, I've heard statistics that Lake Mead will drop 20 more feet this year and could dry up completely by the year 2021. What do you say to those figures?
Well, one of them has potential and the other one's unlikely. So the one that has potential is that the lake could continue to drop. And right now, the lake is at the lake's at about 1,108 feet elevation above sea level. And there is the potential over the next few years that it could go down into the 1070s. And that becomes a threat for us because there's policy that says if the lake gets to certain low levels, then the federal government will reduce the amount of water available to states that are taking water out of the lake. That's what prevents the second scenario that you brought up, that the lake could go dry or just cease to exist. And so while, you know, at the current rates of consumption in a drought, yes, you could mathematically say, well, at some point, the lake will not be able to provide water anymore. What changes is how people use water from that supply, and that's all handled through policy.
Well, thank you so much, Doug.
You're welcome.
Doug Bennett is the conservation manager for the Southern Nevada Water Authority. One of the craziest things I learned from Doug is that the Strip actually only uses 7% of the metered water in all of Las Vegas. That was such a surprise. And on top of that, 75% of the water they use is returned through the city's reuse program, which brings the Strip's actual water use down to just a little bitty 3% of the city's allocation. In fact, over the last 8 years, several of the major properties have hired sustainability czars to monitor and minimize things like water waste. Chris Brophy is one of them. He's the Vice President of Corporate Sustainability for MGM. He oversees all aspects of sustainability in the corporation's 11 properties and 42,000 Las Vegas hotel rooms. The Bellagio, one of MGM's properties, is known for that over-the-top fountain in front that creates quite a spectacle. So I started off asking him, where does that water come from and where does it go?
That water comes from a couple of different sources. Most of the fountains here are driven off of that well water. And so those are well rights that each of the properties have individually. That water then does go down the drain and gets put into the municipal system as well. We also take some of the water from pools that when we drain twice a year, the Osho, for example, their pool gets drained into the Bellagio Lake to do some of that fill. So we're using the water as wisely as we possibly can.
Have you felt a need to create, looking forward, some even more restrictive water measures?
Well, we've taken a lot of steps to reduce our water consumption over the past 5 years. In fact, we've reduced our consumption as a company by 2.5 billion gallons in that time. That's about 2 hours of water flow over Niagara Falls. So yes, we look constantly at what we can do from an operating standpoint, from fixtures within the buildings to how we thaw food, for example, in our kitchens, not using running water to do that, and share those best practices across the property to continue to reduce that water consumption. Landscaping is another way where we've really reduced our water consumption at the properties. Education and outreach is extremely important for us. We have 50,000 employees here in Las Vegas. And so it's incumbent upon us to really educate them on how to use water in their home and how to reduce the water consumption, yards in particular, explaining how use of water in yards is really not good for the city and not good for our long-term viability.
So all of these properties have a bottom line. And I would imagine a big part of meeting that bottom line has to do with food waste and how efficient each restaurant, each food service area is in just utilizing their food costs to the max, just keeping it low as they can, given the profile of what they're serving. How do you deal with food waste here?
Well, there's a few things that we do on the front end, like you're talking about. Obviously, we're trying to order to the demand that we're going to have for given events, especially in the meeting and convention space with our banquet services. We try to confirm the number of people that are going to be attending, the number of meals that should be prepped. In our larger restaurants, we do things that go all the way down to actually measuring the amount of, you know, meat that's being cut off and thrown away, weighing it to make sure that we're keeping our food costs as low as possible. On the kind of back end or middle to back end, we take the food waste that we are producing within the kitchens, within the restaurants, and actually sorting it in the kitchen. That's going then to either compost, or we have a pig farm here in town where we are putting that food to better use as opposed to just putting it out into the landfill.
This has been really terrific. I want to thank you so much for taking the time out to spend with us.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Chris Brophy is the Vice President of Corporate Sustainability for MGM in Las Vegas. The company's implemented several more projects that we didn't get to talk about. Smaller portion sizes, for example, to forestall waste, getting rid of bottled water at the convention center, and sorting through trash for recyclables on the back end. Plus, if you want to hear more about the pig farm that he mentioned, well, we've got a link to an article in Modern Farmer about that very pig farm on our website. And speaking of farms, if you're pining for our usual market report segment, you can find it on our blog as well. We'd never leave you in the lurch. Listen to it to find out what you should be shopping for at Southern California markets this weekend. Sumos are out, artichokes are back. Pretty soon, we'll be seeing a lot of fava beans. Get this week's market report online at kcrw.com/goodfood. In a minute, there are close to 17,000 Hawaiians living in Las Vegas. It's become so popular with the community that Las Vegas is often referred to as the Ninth Island. I'll tell you why. Plus, we've got a taste of the Hawaiian food scene. Stay close.
Good Food is produced by KCRW, a listener-supported public radio station in Los Angeles, California. Support our programming by making a donation. Go to kcrw.com/join.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Stays in Vegas, part two of our Las Vegas special here on Good Food. Hawaiians call Las Vegas the Ninth Island. How and why did this community ever get here from Hawaii? And what food did they bring with them? Writer-reporter E.C. Gladstone met up with us at the epicenter of the Hawaiian migration, the California Hotel. Now, let me tell you where we are. We are decidedly off the strip. We have left the glitz and the glamour. We're downtown in a coffee shop that is like being in a time warp from the 70s. Thank you so much for bringing us here, Eric.
I'm thrilled to be here. Thanks for coming.
How did Las Vegas end up attracting so many Hawaiians?
You know, it's really a great story. There was this guy, Sam Boyd, who is now sort of legendary, who opened this casino, the California Hotel, in 1975 with just sort of a California Gold Rush theme, nothing really special. He was not only not on the Strip, he wasn't even on Fremont Street. And he realized immediately he had a little bit of a problem. He remembered that he had actually been stationed in Hawaii in World War II and that Hawaiians were fanatic about gaming. So he started a charter service, charter flights from Honolulu straight to Las Vegas with package deals for people who stayed and gambled at his hotel. And his company has been doing it ever since then, nonstop.
So how many years is that?
Well, you do the math. It started in 1975, so that would be, we're coming up on 40 years?
So it really is a time warp from the 70s.
Well, the property certainly is. It's stayed updated to a certain extent, but it has become increasingly geared toward its core audience. And when I say core audience, I did a story on this for the Las Vegas Weekly about a couple of years ago. I believe they told me their core clientele is about 60% Hawaiian.
So aside from the Hawaiians that are coming here as tourists from the islands on a package deal and they're going to go home, tell me about the Hawaiians who stayed.
Well, I think after a while, the Hawaiians who were interested in getting off the island realized that it was cheaper for them to fly to Las Vegas than to go anywhere else on the mainland. In fact, it's cheaper for them to go to Las Vegas than it is to fly in between Hawaiian islands. Still. So you can see why that looked awfully attractive, and a lot of the Hawaiians who visited here realized that they could just not leave.
It must have something to do with the fact that it's very expensive to live in Hawaii. I mean, it's the islands, everything has to be brought in. So for a working couple, they could probably make a good go of it here in Las Vegas.
Absolutely. It's very inexpensive here relative to Hawaii in particular. And it's also the hospitality industry, which Hawaiians know as well as anyone. But Hawaiians aren't only in the hospitality industry here. They're also in a lot of construction here. But in particular, there are several Hawaiian chefs on the Strip, and the number of restaurants off the Strip, the number of services with things like Aloha and 808 in their name, 808 being the Hawaiian area code. Companies that start with the word da, D-A, which is just pidgin for the, you just see them more and more.
It's funny because as we were driving around on our way to come to the hotel, we were struck by how, in its own way, Las Vegas is very much an island.
It very much is its own island, so I think that, they can understand that sensibility in a lot of ways. There's a weird connection, even though it's in the desert. It makes sense to Hawaiians.
So let's talk about the food. Right now we're sitting in the California Hotel at Market Street Cafe, and we're about to have a bowl of saimin and butterfish.
So those are two of the few Hawaiian specialties that are offered here. There's another cafe upstairs called Aloha Specialties that is entirely Hawaiian. And then if you went across the casino floor, there's a snack bar where you can also get fried saimin and teriyaki and a bunch of other Hawaiian stuff. And then they have their graveyard special here, oxtail soup, which people come from all over the city to have the oxtail soup here. It's a known thing.
The butterfish is really delicious.
Very true to its name. It's incredibly silky and creamy, and, you know, it's got that teriyaki glaze on it. You know, it's funny. Hawaiian food is not really very well respected by critics here. I think they overlooked it for a long time, and maybe at large, I don't know.
Well, what strikes me about it, looking at this simple plate of fish with the scoop of slightly sticky rice, is how completely unpretentious Hawaiian plate food is. It's so comforting. It's just straightforward, delicious, fills you up, doesn't cost a lot.
Right, very home style, very kind of recipes handed down. And absolutely cheap and filling are kind of the priorities, but not necessarily at the sake of flavor. They're just not delicate about it.
So if we're talking about this kind of food that we're eating right now as being like really homey diner food, when I think about the folks in the hospitality business here, have any Hawaiian chefs sort of made their way into some more important marquee properties and become hotel chefs?
There are several Hawaiian chefs on the Strip, or I would say a good handful. They're only able to incorporate Hawaiian influences to a certain extent in what they're doing, but it does exist and it does come through. And it's starting to mix in subtle ways in other Asian dishes or Pacific Rim dishes. They'll put a touch on it that a non-Hawaiian wouldn't necessarily do.
Give me an example.
An example might be a place that serves lumpia. The lumpia might have a little extra bit of sweetness to it, or maybe a little pineapple glaze, or some of those Hawaiian flavors, mango or something like that, that you wouldn't necessarily see a Filipino chef do, or a Filipino who was originally from Manila or something like that, because there's a great crossover between the Filipino community and the Hawaiian community. As well as there's a lot of crossover with the Korean community here. One of my favorite Hawaiian places here called Island Style is absolutely right down the middle Korean-Hawaiian fusion. So you get bibimbap right next to a Hawaiian fried rice or a lokomoka or something like that.
That sounds like heaven to me. Now all I want to do is explore Hawaiian Las Vegas, and I think it's sort of like turning a corner and going into a different world. Thank you so much.
Evan, it's a pleasure. It's been a lot of fun.
E.C. Gladstone's a writer who covers the Las Vegas food scene for Bon Appetit magazine. Now for a taste of off-strip Las Vegas, we turn to Jonathan Gold, the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the L.A. Times. If you follow Jonathan's writing, then you definitely have heard of Lotus of Siam, what he calls the best Thai restaurant in the country.
Lotus of Siam is run by two people, Saipan and Bill Chutama, who ran Renuna Corn in Norwalk for a long time. And when I first went there, it was 2000, 2001, I had an assignment, as I seem to always have those days, and from Gourmet, where I would go to Las Vegas and write about the new restaurants. But there was a pretty bad crop of new casino restaurants then. I think I'd just gone to like 5 or 6 bad fancy French meals in a row, and I was really depressed. And I remember hearing that maybe the Chudamas had like left Renunacorn and they'd opened a place in a strip mall in Las Vegas, so I went to check it out.
And when you got to the strip mall, were you dismayed with their location?
Well, there were an awful lot of massage parlors in the strip mall. I mean, the strip mall is enormous, by the way. I mean, the parking lot looks like it's big enough to hold 2 football stadiums. I mean, the skating rink there is big enough that Led Zeppelin played their Las Vegas concert there in 1969. But Lotus of Siam was a small restaurant, and it was completely dominated, at least at lunchtime, by this buffet, by a $4.99 lunch buffet. People were going, they were loading their plates with chicken rings and fried rice, and it wasn't a cheerful-looking place.
And given that you had talked about Renunacorn so highly when they were in Norwalk, were you saddened?
I guess. I wasn't expecting much. I mean, Renunacorn was my favorite Thai restaurant in L.A. at the time, and I brought everybody there. And I think Bittman ended up writing it for the New York Times, and it became Mary Sue and Susan's favorite Thai restaurant that they brought people to. And it had sort of become a stop on the Los Angeles foodie itinerary. So I was hoping that something would be good. And I get the menu and I realize that the menu is not just like the Renunacorn menu. It is the Renunacorn menu. And I order some of my favorites on it, you know, the crispy rice salad and the fried catfish with mint and the larb, you know, the Northern Thai salad and a couple other things. And the food was extraordinary. It was even better than it had been. And I kept going back and back. And I think I ended up going there 4 or 5 days in a row by the time the trip was over.
So now we're going to cut to 2014. We've just been driving in the car for like 4 hours. We were hungry. So we pull off the side of the road into the famed strip mall of many massage parlors,
which are still there.
And yet the restaurant is quite different.
It's completely packed. It's 4 times the size. It has to be at least. There's a giant glassed-in wine cellar with a selection of Rieslings that is much larger than anything in Southern California, at least. There's a long wait, 45 minutes to an hour. And people are at Lotus of Siam because they've heard that it's the best Thai restaurant in the country. I had said it was the best Thai restaurant in the country, you know, in Gourmet all those years ago. And somehow it had the imprimatur of Gourmet attached to it. So people started to believe it. And it's an interesting crowd because it's everybody who goes to Las Vegas, right? It's people who go to conventions. It's people with beehive hairdos. It's young couples on date night. It's expensive. It's more expensive than any Thai restaurant in L.A. probably. But it's a total happening. Very few Thai people, by the way.
But a lot of locals, as we were standing there for 45 minutes waiting for our table, it was interesting to sort of pick out the locals and hear them talk to one another.
Definitely.
Given the enormous increase in size, and it is quite impressive. I mean, I've never been in a Thai restaurant anywhere as large. There's just room after room after room. Were you happy with the quality of the meal we had?
I was. I mean, if you look at, say, Chowhound, or you read Yelp, or you do any of the other sort of like user sites, everybody is always saying constantly that Lotus of Siam is going downhill. I mean, to hear them, you'd think it had like descended to the level of, you know, a takeout restaurant that gives you free chow mein if you order $10. But it's not. It's exactly the same as it's ever been. There's some more, let's say, upscale friendly dishes. And they'll do things like the traditional Northern Thai noodle soup, you know, cow soy. They'll do it with salmon instead of – or in addition to the original chicken or pork. But it's not really hurt that much by having salmon in it. And you can order, you know, absolutely traditional things. Like when we went there, we had the nam prik um, which is that roasted chili dip that comes with freshly fried chicharron and like slices of Thai eggplant to dip in it. We had a jackfruit curry that I think may have actually been too authentic for you.
Yeah, I have to say the thing that I liked the most were the catfish, and that crispy rice was just incredible.
Yeah, their version of the crispy rice salad, Nam Khao Tat, is really good. There are places in L.A. that do it well. Renew Unicorn does a fine job, and I really like the one at Night Market. But the thing that Lotus Siam does that's a little bit different is that the rice is clumped. So there are like loose, crispy parts, and there are clumped parts that are a little bit chewy. And, you know, there's the sharpness of the lime juice and the heat of the chili, and it all comes together really nicely. Little slices of homemade Thai Spam.
Well, thank you so much, Jonathan.
Thank you.
I've been talking to Jonathan Gold about eating off the strip at Lotus of Siam in Las Vegas. You can get a text message with the restaurant's address and Jonathan's recommended dishes by texting Good Food to 69866. That's Good Food to 69866. Next week, we'll return our focus to LA when Jonathan reviews Church and State. Coming up, could one of the country's best cookbook collections be sitting in a strip mall in a Las Vegas suburb? We make a field trip to the Amber Unicorn Bookstore next.
Good Food is produced by KCRW, a listener-supported public radio station. Search for KCRW in the podcast section of iTunes to find other programs like Bookworm, The Treatment, The Business, Unfictional, and DNA. And thanks for listening.
You're listening to Stays in Vegas, part two of Good Food's Vegas special. How incredible is it that here in Las Vegas, there exists this gem of a bookstore, the Amber Unicorn, in a mini mall that is enormous. And I'm standing here amidst volumes and volumes and volumes of cookbooks with one of the owners, Myrna Donato. Hi.
Hi. It's nice to meet you.
It's lovely to meet you. I have to know how the passion began. Did it? Because this isn't only a cookbook store. It's a used bookstore,
correct,
of which a huge portion are cookbooks.
Correct. I didn't know I really, well, I've always liked cookbooks, and I didn't know I had collected until I met my husband. And he was in the used book field. And he looked at my cookbooks and said, "My God, what a great collection." And I go, "Well, they're just mine." And it went from there, because then we opened a store together. And my cookbooks have just multiplied. I think they multiply at night.
Because we've lost, I mean, in Southern California, we've lost some really important cookbook stores. When Ellen Rose closed, that was really, really sad. So as a book collector, there's a difference between a simple used book and then an antiquarian book, or a book that has some value either for its rareness or maybe it's the book jacket. So do you also get into that part of the business?
In fact, yesterday I cried a lot because this gentleman brought in a copy of an 1897 White House cookbook. That it's the first one I've ever seen where the pages had not started to fall apart. Unfortunately, it was completely disbound, and to repair it would have been cost prohibitive. And I told him what I'd give him for it as it was, and he said, "Well, for that, I'll just put it back in the box and keep it for another 20 years. But I get those on occasion, not nearly as often as I would like, because most of the time, by the time people move to Las Vegas, they've already gotten rid of most of their books. I don't have a readily supply of older cookbooks like I'd like. The more current ones I can get any day, but the old ones I can't.
Do you have a particular either era or type of food or author or series that is really close to your heart?
The one that's really close to my heart is the original first edition Betty Crocker. I learned to cook out of that when I was 10 years old, and I still have my copy, and it's still a very valid cookbook. And if somebody comes in and says, well, I'm just getting into cooking, I don't know anything, that's the one I'll recommend.
You're talking about the plaid cookbook.
Mm-hmm.
I still have my original copy.
I got one that was a presentation copy, and I hated parting with it because there's so few of them around. It's blue.
Oh.
And it comes in a slipcase, and it was bound in that color and presented to the 47 people that put together the original Betty Crocker cookbook before it was released to the public. They're all dedicated to one of the people, and it's signed by whoever was playing Betty Crocker at the time. But it was pretty awesome.
And what's the rarest book that's ever crossed your desk?
Ooh. I had one that was a 1912. It was called Cook's Cookbook. And it was written in Japanese with American subtitles for the Japanese chefs coming to America to cook for American families. And in the back of the book were all the American utensils so that they would know what to use. And that's probably been about one of my rarest ones. Another one was the, and it's not that rare, The Dinner's Legala by Dolly, and it was signed. And it was still in the original mailer.
So much fun. This has been great. Thank you so much, Myrna.
Oh, you're quite welcome. It's been wonderful talking to you.
Myrna Donato and her husband own the Amber Unicorn Used Bookstore. You've been listening to Stays in Vegas, the second and final, episode of our Las Vegas special. Thanks for tuning in. If you want to hear this week's market report with Laura Avery, you can find it on the Good Food blog at kcrw.com/goodfood. Thank you so much to my lovely traveling companions, Jonathan Gold and Jillian Ferguson, who produced today's show. Also a big thanks to writer E.C. Gladstone, who you heard today talking about the Hawaiian community in Vegas. I'm Evan Kleiman. Tune in next week with more from Good Food.